From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Not every story has two sides.
You're doing a disservice by having one climate change skeptic and not 97 or 98 scientists or engineers concerned about climate change.
That is Bill Nye rebuking CNN for inviting him to square off with a climate change denier. That debate is one example of false equivalence, and we'll break down what that means later this hour. First, though, last week we talked with the creator of Brotherman Comics.
We wanted the attribute of the hero to be representative of that man in the community who we felt as though does not get shine. So it's basically like taking men like my father, some of the teachers that I had, and creating mythology out of them, an action adventure out of them.
We asked for some of your favorite fictional heroes, and here are your first thoughts.
My name is Andromeda Mobius. I live in Hawkinsville, Georgia. My most favorite fictional character is Fern, out of Charlotte's Web by E.B. White.
Oh, look at him. He's absolutely perfect. His name is Wilbur.
We always love to know what you think and what characters you love. Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia hosted a gathering of micronations this summer. Not sure what those are? Well, it's not surprising. Micronations are small, self-proclaimed entities which claim to be independent sovereign states but are not acknowledged as such by any recognized sovereign state or any supranational organization. 27 self-proclaimed nations, many from Georgia, gathered in Dunwoody recently for MicroCon. It was a four-day event hosted by Queen Anastasia von Elfberg of Ruritania. Ruritania is a micronation near Stone Mountain. Oliver Noble's a film producer for Vice Media. He was at MicroCon and made a documentary about what he saw there, and he joins me from New York. Hi, Oliver.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. And Ryan Lenz is with us as well, an investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks.
Oliver, what makes a MicroCon convention good documentary fodder? I assume you didn't go there to sort of poke fun at people.
I mean, no more than they're poking fun at themselves. I think a lot of them have a sense of humor about what they're doing. Some don't particularly, but they're all interesting characters, and that's what attracted me to it.
So,
it's also an interesting sort of, they're all interesting experiments in government to a certain extent as well.
So let's actually hear from Queen Anastasia of Ruritania. Again, this is a micronation near Storm Mountain. She's talking here about how she attracts most of her quote-unquote citizens.
We also get a lot of people trying desperately to leave third world countries. They think that we're a country with enough land that they could move here. We can give them a citizenship, but it comes without residency.
Ryan, who are these micronation founders? From what I understand, they're neither necessarily left-leaning or right-leaning. Who are they?
Well, you know, a number of different founders have started micronations for a number of different reasons, and it really depends on, you know, what they're after. You know, some have created micronations for, you know, theoretical experimentation, a political statement, some sort of artistic expression, or just for fun, you know. But there are those that conduct or that create the concept of a micronation for criminal activity, both on the left and the right. On the left, we've seen people declare micronations to protect, you know, whales and various parts of the ocean. And on the right, we see people create micronations with the idea of subverting the federal government or to be there if and when the federal government fails to stand up as the new America. So, I mean, it's really a broad, kind of a wild subsection of the American public who, you know, who's turned on by this idea.
So let's hear a comment from, it sounds like, one of the more benign rulers. This is Eric Liss. He's emperor of the Erican Empire. That's American without the M. And here's his sales pitch for joining his micronation.
There are absolutely no tangible benefits to being a member of the Erican Empire. It is purely something that someone can be happy about. Naturally, we do sell banknotes and coins and printable passports and citizenship certificates. But really, it's not a question of tangible benefit. It's a question of just belonging. And when you get right down to it, that's really one of the most powerful things in the world.
So, Oliver, what was the purpose of having a convention of these people? It seems like their whole purpose is to be totally independent, right? So why have a conference?
Well, I think they see it sort of like a UN kind of thing where independent countries still meet and discuss global issues. And a lot of them feel that they can accomplish more by working together. And I think it's also a bit of an excuse for them to all get together and stamp each other's passports and show the different currencies they're working.
Are you speaking metaphorically, or do they actually stamp each other's passports?
No, quite literally. Yeah, most of them have passports, and many of them have currency and postage stamps, which I believe are not recognized by the U.S. postal system.
I'm sure they're not.
But if you slap a few on, I think they've been known to go through as well.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Vice documentary producer Oliver Noble, whose voice you just heard, and also Ryan Lenz, an investigative reporter for the SPLC. Oliver, any idea why there are so many of these in Georgia and why the convention was here?
To be honest, I'm not sure that there are that many of them in Georgia. I know the one, Ruritania, which Queen Anastasia is the ruler of, is there. I think a lot of them are all across the country. There's about 300 active ones, and also in Europe and all different parts of the world as well. There were some people there from France, a couple of micronations from Canada were represented. So there may be others in Georgia, but the only one I know of for sure is Ruritania.
All right, so then let's hear again from Queen Anastasia. Again, her country, her micronation is Ruritania. Her real name is Veronica Boritz, and her micronation is near Stone Mountain.
Ruritania is, and all micronations for that matter, are more of a political statement than an ideology. We don't care for the way things are going in the countries we come from. And we think we could do a better job, even if it's just over a postage stamp-sized piece of property.
So, Ryan, when does as far as law enforcement is concerned, when is this going to go from something that is sort of benign and amusing to something that's of concern?
Well, I mean, as we just heard, you know, the woman, what was her name, Ruritania?
You know, her nation is Ruritania. She is Queen Anastasia.
Okay, Queen Anastasia says, they left, you know, they started their own country because they were unhappy with, you know, something about the country in which they lived. And that's not that dissimilar from what drives people on the radical right to start, say, you know, sovereign nations unto themselves. You know, there's a growing sovereign citizen movement in this country that has sort of turned on by this idea. Let me tell you a story of a man named James Timothy Turner, who was a commercial fisherman in southern Alabama and in Florida, worked for a time for FEMA, and he bought into this conspiracy theory that after the Civil War, the federal government had never been reconvened in a proper fashion consistent with what the Constitution would demand. And therefore, the federal government before the Civil War began was still dormant and ready to be occupied. So he went about the process of creating that government, you know, recognizing or saying that the federal government in Washington, D.C. was completely illegitimate, in fact, criminal. So he starts what's called the Republic for the United States of America. And it grows to include members basically in all 50 states with elected officials. And what's really started to attract law enforcement attention was when he started to build, you know, sort of on the armed services of his government. And then he started to encourage people to trade in RUSA money. And it
RUSA standing for the Republic for the United States.
Right, of America. And so he, you know, he ultimately was convicted on several tax evasion charges in 2014, and is now serving a lengthy federal prison term. But the point of this, I think, example is that, you know, the idea of disappearing or separating yourself from your host nation to create a nation of your own is both, you know, sort of fanciful, based on the stories we've heard today, but also quite dangerous in some ways. You know, because if employed by, you know, if used by the wrong person with the wrong motivation, it can turn quite dangerous and quite tense.
Okay, so let's hear again from the Vice media documentary. This is Kevin Baugh, I think that's how you pronounce it, president of Malasia. He's talking about how he got into all of this.
I wasn't even aware that there were other micronations out there until the advent of the internet. You know, you get out there and start looking around like, whoa, that guy's got his own country, he declared. That guy's got his own country.
So, Oliver, what sense did you get is there any sense that among those micronations, a certain portion of them are actually thinking about becoming sovereign citizens, actually seriously establishing their own independent republic?
Well, there's certainly a history of that, and like one of the most well-known micronations is Sealand, which was off the coast of, I believe, England, and had a history of sort of subverting laws. And I think even the Pirate Bay, which is a BitTorrenting site, was considering buying Sealand at one point to try and get around.
I want to make sure everyone's staying with you. You're talking about the Principality of Sealand.
Yes.
That's the Ruff's Tower. It's an offshore platform that they've said is a micronation, not the attraction where you can go see orcas in captivity. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, yes. Thank you. So there has been that and other cases, but I think that was a little more in the 20th century. And now, at least the people at MicroCon this year did not seem like they were a danger to the government. For example,
although one has
Kevin
to
Paugh,
wonder if you were, would you go to a convention?
Yeah, yes. I mean, there may be other there may be others out there, but from what I saw there, it's a little more tongue in cheek. For example, Kevin Ball, who you were just hearing that clip from on their site. One of the questions is, do you pay federal taxes? And their answer is no, but we contribute to foreign aid in the same amount as our federal taxes would be. So I think that's essentially their way of saying
yeah, their way
paying
of paying taxes. But yeah. Ryan, in the minute and a half that we have left, we just talked on this show about sort of a very serious, newly emerging conversation about secession. So at what point do you think we as a nation have to worry about the anti-government sovereign citizen movement?
Well, I mean, we're already worried about it quite seriously. You know, the FBI in 2011 announced that that sovereign citizens were among the nation's top domestic terrorist threats. That, of course, you know, remains to be seen if that holds through the current administration. But sometimes these groups can be very much a threat and a worry for a nation or a community in which they exist. It really all depends on whether they view themselves as sort of, you know, good neighbors, so to speak, or whether they view themselves, in which case their ideas are still, you know, completely unrecognized, or if they see themselves as seceding or removing themselves to form a micronation for the purposes of some political grievance. And then that's the fodder for conflict.
Well, it's definitely interesting, and the documentary comes from Vice Media. Oliver Noble is a video producer with Vice Media. He visited the convention for micronations in Dunwoody. And you just heard the voice of Ryan Lenz, senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Oliver and Ryan, thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, is a climate scientist on equal footing with a climate change denier? First, though, journalist Wesley Lowery talks about reporting from the front lines of America's protests. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 3 years ago, Ferguson, Missouri exploded into national headlines when an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, was shot and killed by police. Protests erupted in many cities, including Atlanta. And now Charlottesville is just the latest example of heightened racial tensions around the country and perhaps rising violence. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Wesley Lowery covers race and justice for the Washington Post, and his new book is called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Lowery speaks this week at the Decatur Book Festival and at Emory University. Hi there.
Hey, how are you doing?
It's good to have you with us. I want to start with the subtitle where you book where you call it a new era in America's racial justice movement. What makes you think this is a new era and not a continuation of the civil rights movement that began in the 50s and 60s?
Well, I actually don't see a distinction between those two things, right? It's a new era, meaning a new chapter, a new version. What we obviously have is new people, right? The young activists and demonstrators, the people who took to the streets in Ferguson and Baltimore, are obviously different people than the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. I mean, in fact, you know, part of what the book does is it chronicles the question of who are these folks leading many of these demonstrations? Who are the young men and women who are so moved by what they saw as an injustice in Ferguson, that they sacrificed their own physical bodies as well as, you know, in many cases, their jobs, their educations, to take up these kind of lives of activism. And so what we see, I mean, I think unquestionably, beginning in the 2000s and in the era that is ushered in by the election of Barack Obama, we do see a distinct era in our conversation nationally about race in America, in part, if only, because that's a conversation happening with a backdrop of a black president. And so the hope here is to chronicle and talk about this kind of period of time stretching back essentially to the election of Barack Obama forward to today.
So one of the things which seems different to me, although I was not around during the first civil rights movement, and neither were you, but it seems...
No, I was not.
It seems there... We're both a little too young, but it seems there is a growing distrust or an existing distrust of almost everything. Many of the people that the interviews that you recount, the conversations that you recount, show that they, at the time they were even speaking with you, they weren't sure whether to trust you. They weren't sure what journalists to trust. They weren't sure what government agencies to trust. How does that then play out during protests?
Of course. Well, what I think is, you know, it's unclear to what extent that distrust always existed or always there, even it manifested in different ways, perhaps. However, you know, what I do think is different about this moment was that people taking to the streets are empowered in a way they never quite were before, and because they can chronicle and document their own causes and their own gatherings themselves in a way that is different, right? And so if you think about Ferguson, Missouri, for example, you had thousands of people in the streets, and then dozens, maybe hundreds of those people who are basically live tweeting everything that's happening. They're taking photos, they're taking videos, they're giving instructions, they're saying, can you believe it? The police just moved us from this street corner to this one, right? So because of that, there was this feeling that they didn't necessarily need, whether it be the media or the kind of other outside arbiters, to chronicle what was happening, because they felt as if they could do it themselves. I think that there's always this kind of push and pull. We see this often as members of the media, where we show up and we are, essentially we're trying to convince folks to trust us and to talk to us. And the argument we make very often is, well, look, without us, how are you going to tell your story? It's important that this gets out there. What turned that on its head a little bit in recent years has been cell phones and social media, right? That people now more so than ever feel empowered to tell their own stories, which means they hold us and the media to a much higher standard. They're just not going to talk to everyone with a camera or a notebook, because they don't have to. If they really want to get something out, they can do it themselves.
But this is one of the issues that comes up through your book, is the both the pros and cons of citizen journalism. And I think to a certain extent, Sean King might be an example of this, that there is a difference between the reporting that comes from a journalist and some of this on the ground gut reaction, not always fact checked, not always sourced information that comes from so-called citizen journalists or activists. How does that make a journalist's job more difficult or maybe less?
Well, I think it does both things. I mean, the first is that the more people, I think one of the ways that it makes a journalist's job easier is that the more people you have creating accounts of what they're seeing and talking about, it's a tip sheet. It helps you figure out who you should even be calling, right? That to have someone live tweet something that they just saw, whether it, you know, later on, I want to go back through the specifics of whether they used all the words they wanted to use, or were they being hyperbolic with something. I at least know who I should call to ask now, as opposed to having to figure out who was there. Right. On the other hand, there is a world in which, because people can publish themselves, there's less of a barrier to entry of that. And so you can very quickly have things go viral, have things become common knowledge or conventional wisdom that may or may not be true. And there is a difficulty there. I think that underscores the importance and and the role of journalists in this moment, right? At a time when everyone can publish, when everyone can weigh in, when everyone can in real time document what they say they are seeing and experiencing. It's more important than ever to have people whose job it is to kind of calmly and coolly walk back through behind that and check and see, what really matches up and what does not.
Now, you first came to National Headlines because you were arrested. You were arrested while you were working at a McDonald's. What was that like to suddenly become part of a story that you were trying to keep some kind of journalistic objectivity from?
Sure. I mean, I think it was an relatively unpleasant experience, if only because, you know, in the polarized environment we live in now, in the world in which we're all kind of in our own ideological bunker, myself and Ryan Riley at the Huffington Post, we were, both the first of dozens of journalists who ended up being taken into custody at some point in Ferguson. We became these kind of whipping boys or heroes, depending on what exactly your politics were, right? And so we had people to the political right, saying that we had just done this on purpose, got ourselves arrested on purpose. Oh, we had these far right wing bloggers. I think some woman wrote one time that, we were the example of everything wrong with the American man today. Or so, we just became this, these characters to be attacked and beat up on. If you didn't like what was happening in Ferguson, we were the problem, right? And on the other side, you also have some lionization at times that felt either exaggerated or not even necessarily fair or distracting from the story we were attempting to tell. What was fascinating, that was the third or fourth day I was on the ground, there were just so many compelling characters, so many compelling stories, people I'd been interviewing, things that were happening each night, and this focus on us and these arrests at times did detract and did distract from what I think was a larger and more important story, even as it was bringing additional eyeballs to that story.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery. He's speaking this week at the Decatur Book Festival and Emory University about his book, They Can't Kill Us All. And that title comes from a protest sign that you saw in Ferguson, does it not?
Yes, it does. It was following the shooting of Antonio Martin, which was a shooting, I want to say it was in December 2014. And so it's after Michael Brown, after Jimmy Powell. And this was a shooting that the police and the elected officials would say was, a quote-unquote good shooting, right? This was someone who was armed with a gun who, on video, it looked like he had pulled it on the officers. And yet still people showed up. People were still there with signs, demanding answers, demanding accountability. And I think it showed two different things, right? I think that it underscored something that I think has been thematically true of these last few years, and that is that folks are no longer willing to sanitize who they rally around and who they do not, right? It's a world in which people believe that police shootings are happening too often, about three a day in the United States of America, and that there is a skepticism of the police version of stories, no matter what that story is, and there's a demand for accountability and information each time. But beyond that, That sign really struck to me and spoke to me in part because I just thought it was a powerful distillation of what so many of these activists and protesters are talking about, right? This is a book that tries to tell the story of why did so many of these young people step into the street? Who are they? What are their backstories? How did they get here? And the reason that we settled on this sign as the title of this book is because I think it really, if there was one message that the hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people who stepped in the street were attempting to impart during those years, it's that no, there are so many of us, and you cannot keep killing us. This has to stop, right? And I think that it was a powerful message. And so I thought very often I was writing this book back to that sign, and that's kind of how we settled on that as the title.
So I hate to do this to you because we only have 1 minute left, but do you think that where we have come, where we are now with Charlottesville and the other unrest that's going on, was it inevitable? Was there anything that could have been done?
I do think it's inevitable, if only because I think that what we're seeing now in public are tensions that have simmered in private for generations, right? What's different is that we're now talking about things and confronting things in public spaces that previously we would like to pretend did not exist, right? We would kind of politely say, no, well, we've come such a long way, and no, people don't feel that way. When in reality, these types of tensions and these feelings expressed by these kind of white supremacist neo-Nazi groups have always existed in our society. And I think that the reality is the sooner we can confront and name something, the sooner we have a chance of addressing it.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery. He's author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley speaks this week at the Decatur Book Festival and at Emory University. You can get details at gpbnews.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
On Friday, President Trump signed a directive banning transgender military recruits. That change also halts the U.S. Defense and Homeland Security from supporting sex change surgery for those now serving. The only exception is for transgender service members already in treatment. The president gave his Secretary of Defense 6 months to come up with a plan on those currently serving, which must be implemented by March 23rd. Transgender activist Monica Helms of Marietta served honorably in the Navy for 8 years. She later created the transgender pride flag, now an internationally recognized symbol. Helms believes the transgender community deserves the same chance as anyone else to serve in the military.
I pushed around 16 nuclear missiles in the Atlantic Ocean to keep the Russians from blowing us up. And I protected the rights of every American when I was in the military. And I don't seem to get all those rights. There's something wrong with that. My name is Monica Helms, and I'm a transgender activist. I served in the military from 1970 to 1978, and I didn't realize that I was different until the middle of my term in service. And I had to keep it a very strong secret because I knew how they reacted to these kinds of things. I kept all my girl things in my van when I was serving. That way I didn't have anything with me when I was on board the submarine, so I didn't have to worry about anybody finding out. I was very proud of serving in the military, and especially on submarines. My family comes with a very long history of military people. I have uncles that served during the war. My father served in 3 branches of service and in 3 wars. My grandfather served in the Navy. My son was a Marine. My brother was an Army person. And his son is an Air Force person at this time. So I have a long history of military service, and I wanted to honorably serve. And so I did not want to leave the Navy until my time was up. The morning that President Trump tweeted about kicking transgender people out of the military, it was just horrible to see the president say such things that we were not worthy in his eyes to serve our country, and yet many of us have served, and many of us are serving openly today. The president is just throwing out a lot of BS when it comes to the money involved in transgender people. First of all, there's not a heck of a lot of us in the military. And second of all, not every one of them is going to want any kind of transitioning services. Many of the people serving today have already transitioned. There's there's an estimate that 400 women served as men in the Civil War for both sides. We have people who have been from corporals all the way up to colonels and generals, and they have served honorably, some with high security clearances, and many of the friends that I have served 20 years in the military, coming out with an honorable discharge. So there is a lot of people. The history is full of them.
That was transgender activist Monica Helms of Marietta, a Navy submariner from 1970 to 1978. She later transitioned and went on to create the transgender pride flag. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. Just ahead, President Trump was accused of false equivalence during his first response to the events in Charlottesville. But what does that mean? I'll break it down. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We hope you join us tomorrow for a full hour dedicated to Southern food. We've got a panel of experts to discuss everything from what makes a food truly Southern to how what we eat influences our politics and human rights. So do you think food can be political? Or is that just putting too much meaning on what we eat? Call us at 404-500-9457 and then be sure to join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow for that conversation. When Donald Trump addressed the tragic events in Charlottesville, Virginia, he said there was bad behavior on both sides.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists. I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides, I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
Many people accuse the president of false equivalence. That phrase has come up a lot in the past couple years, whether we're talking about Nazis or Benghazi or emails or Black Lives Matter. False equivalence is a phrase used all the time, but not fully understood by many people. And so, it's time to break it down. What if I were to say that a sushi knife and a razor are equally sharp and so equally good at shaving your beard?
These are my clippers. I call it Excalibeard.
That's a false equivalence, and if you make that error in logic, you're apt to end up with a bloody face.
Look who got bait with the ugly stick.
False equivalence is a logical fallacy.
Liar, liar, plants for hire.
It's pants on fire, Patrick.
Well, you would know, liar.
There are easily more than 130 recognized fallacies, but this one is among the most common. Here's how it works. Say you have two items, a pencil and a desk. The pencil is wooden and small. The desk is wooden and large. A false equivalence would treat both items the same because they're both wooden.
I respect all wood.
I respect pine. I respect walnut. I respect oak. Doesn't matter.
They have one characteristic in common, so you act as though there's no difference. But there's no room on your pencil for a laptop, and the desk is too heavy to stick behind your ear. It's like saying a greyhound and a dachshund have an equal chance to win a race because they're both hounds. Or grass and avocados are equally delicious. They're both green, after all.
Mr. Yuck is mean. Mr. Yuck is green.
Your neighbor who spilled oil in his driveway is not the same as the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Yes, toxic substances were spilled in both cases, but one is minor, while the other is the largest marine oil spill in the history of the petroleum industry. Not the same. Be careful not to mistake false equivalence for false balance. In false equivalence, you treat two different things equally just because they share one common characteristic. False balance refers to journalism's mistaken practice of presenting every issue as though it has two equal sides, like a scientist speaking on climate change versus a denier who just doesn't think it's real.
The idea that CO2 is the tail that wags the dogs is not supportable.
That's false balance. Then there is the specific kind of false equivalence called moral equivalence. In Charlottesville, you had one group of protesters expressing racial hatred and white supremacy versus another group of protesters chanting their opposition to hatred and fascism. Both groups are not the same just because they're both protesting. A soldier who killed enemies during wartime is not the same as a serial killer. They have killing in common, but the rest is quite different, especially what each may be fighting for. False equivalence can also be called false comparison. It's comparing oranges to apples because they're both fruit. But let's bring in an actual expert. Ed Lee is the executive director of the Barclay Forum for Debate, Deliberation, and Dialogue at Emory University. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Did we get everything basically correct?
Yes. It was a good introduction in the way in which we should understand these things. At the core of this issue really is an appeal to the notion of objectivity and that things are equal, they have credibility, all sides of a perspective needs to be equally weighted, and even from a sense of morality, we need to understand things of having an equal place, and that's a dangerous place to be.
So you said that this is an introduction to that concept. So let's get into chapter one. This idea that false equivalence comes as a result of a goal of objectivity, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Or the appearance of objectivity.
I think that in our community, in our society, there's a desire for us to have equal weighting, equal footing for perspectives.
Right. There are no stupid questions.
There's a sense of fairness about it and a sense of attracting, and that this comes from a good place. Actually, as a debate coach, I am interested in an exploration of all sides, but in thinking about exploring the all sides, we don't want to give legitimacy and credibility to all perspectives as if there is equal. There is a sense of evil that exists in the world, there is a sense of truth that exists in the world, and this notion of a false equivalence or a moral equivalence sort of elides that notion that there is a difference that exists.
I would say, I mean, as a journalist, I will just lay some of the blame at my own industry's feet, which is that journalism's abdication of responsibility in deciding truth. In other words, we don't want to say what's right or what's wrong, so we're just going to bring in two sides to argue it out. Has that false balance that journalism has practiced for the past 20 years, has that led to this sort of rise in false equivalence?
Well, I think that they are informed in some ways by that, and that I think that you're right, that journalism has created a notion that if we have as an example, a consensus on climate science where 97% of the published scientists believes that there is climate change, that it is informed by humans, and that if we bring in one scientist who says that, we need to bring in one denier that says that, that assumes that, well, now there's a 50-50 split within the scientific community on this particular issue. That's wrong. And for the community, for people who are not involved in that particular research, who are listening to the information, they believe that there's an actual debate occurring around climate change where there's really not much of a debate on whether or not it is occurring and whether or not humans are inducing it. There's a debate on whether or not the consequences and what will happen because of it. The same thing is occurring in terms of Charlottesville and the notion of white supremacy. By having this false equivalence take place, we could introduce into our communities a notion that there's an actual debate about the legitimacy of white supremacy as a mode of engagement and an ideology that people should accept.
And that's what makes it dangerous, not kind of dangerous, but that's what makes it dangerous, period. I want to give you an example of a note that a listener sent me. But first, let me just let people know, if you're just joining us, we're talking about false equivalence, what it is and the effects that it has. My guest is Ed Lee. He is the executive director of the Barclay Forum for Debate, Deliberation, and Dialogue at Emory University, three words I very much like. So I got this note. I had posted, because we're having this public discussion about Confederate monuments, I had posted a couple articles discussing the Confederacy, and a listener sent me a note saying, if you every time that you talk about slavery or the Confederacy, you need to also bring up child labor in the North. And I thought to myself, well, this is kind of fortuitous, because that's, to me, an example of false equivalence. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And there's one of the ways in which we should also think about this is what's the motive and purpose of doing that. One goal that we can have in introducing that there are other evils, other harms that took place during that period of time is to, one, ignore the unique differences that did take place between potentially child labor in the North and the odious forms of segregation, dehumanization that was a part of an institution of slavery that was a part of maintaining an economy and destroying various people and various communities as a part of that process. The other thing that it does is that it sends some signals that we may not be able to do anything about any of these injustices because there are so many, and that we should ignore how we could act to address one because we are unable to address the other. One of the ways of thinking about this is sort of the notion of working a referee doing a sports game, that if we can't call fouls on everybody or locate the fouls on everyone, then we shouldn't call fouls on anyone, that everyone is objectionable in this particular thing. And so we should just let it play out. And that we should let the market or let all individuals decide. But when we do that, there are levers of power that are being worked in one particular direction to support some particular types of systems that will continue to do so.
Well, I mean, parents see this all the time. Kids are always trying to get out of trouble by saying that their sibling did something worse, right, the
yes.
other day. But I want to talk again about some of the effects of what happens when you use false equivalence. And I wonder if what it basically does is undermine everybody. In other words, false equivalence sort of takes away everybody's position to criticize or point out fault in a way, right?
Well, yes. Here's a way to think about it, particularly in the context of the events in Charlottesville, that we have developed what is almost a near universal norm in our society against white supremacy, that neo-Nazis, the KKK, has really been relegated to the hinterlands of politics at this particular juncture.
Right.
That if we create an environment, if we want to undermine that norm, the only thing that we have to do is really undermine a sense of a shared purpose for us to continue to relegate them there and to undermine a common sense of identification of people in this country, that one of the things that we have in common is that we do not see white power, white control as something that is an ideology that is equal to an ideology of preserving a notion of equal rights. A sense of equivalence between those two, white power, white control, and a pursuit of equal justice, equal rights, undermines that particular norm, and it tends to bring the ideology that we once found to be harmful and injurious and something that we do not see as being American closer to being something that is normalized and legitimized in our society. And that's the part that's dangerous about it.
And some of the ways in which this happens is just through naming things. And by that, I mean white supremacists have chosen, it was Richard Spencer, a neo-Nazi, who chose the word alt-right.
Yes.
And now people are calling anti-fascists alt-left. So in a way, even by using names, we are creating a false equivalence, right?
Yes, there's extreme power in communication and the words that we use. Language matters. That the first way in which we come
to identify.
Well,
of course you'd say that. You're a debate teacher. Yeah, well, yeah. You're biased.
Well, yes.
Yes.
And in reality, we're all biased. Understanding that bias just means sort of partial, and that we all are. But one of the ways in which we come to construct and identify particular collections of people is by labeling them, by understanding that linguistical choices really impart a particular notion of morality, good and evil. Things aren't inherently good or bad. They come to be such based upon the way in which we come to speak to them and understand them. And so when we say there is now this notion of an alt-left that exists in comparison to and also equal to the alt-right, it indicates that we should come to understand the alt-left as having an objective that is just as harmful as the way in which we have come to see the objective of the alt-right. And so that language choice that was chosen by Richard Spencer and then legitimized by President Trump tends to say that the choices that are made by those who are attempting to resist fascism, resist segregation, resist white supremacy, that we should be just as concerned about it as one would hope we are about a collection of people who are interested in reinscribing some systems of control, dominance, and an attempt to roll back opportunities of opportunities for equality and justice in this society.
And just so listeners can understand how off that equivalence is, 75% over the past, I think it's 10 to 15 years, of the 75% of all homicides that were motivated by political ideology were carried out by someone from the so-called alt-right, a right-wing person, and less than 2% were carried out by someone on the left. There's not really a statistical equivalence between the two. Yet we're making a false equivalence between the two sides, probably for political reasons. We only have about a minute and a half left, but how do I, as a news-consuming public, recognize false equivalence when it's being used?
Well, one of the things that I would encourage us to do is to be skeptical about any of these comparisons when they are made, and to strive to understand the nuances that are there, that there is real difficulties that exist here, because what we have to do is to inoculate people in beforehand against false equivalence and other forms of argumentative fallacy, because misinformation is ultimately resistant to corrections. That when there's misinformation that is presented and it conforms or confirms our understanding of the world, we tend to take that in and accept it as our truth. So what we have to do is build within the media and within education inoculation strategies that teach people how to identify, here's a sense of false equivalence, here's why it's dangerous, and here's how we are to understand how to explore the truth and have more nuanced perspectives. So I appreciate you inviting me on and having this conversation, because I think that this is part of the way in which we get people to think in some more nuanced and skeptical ways about the information we're consuming.
And since we're talking about false equivalence, and because the comparison to Hitler is made about so many people, I might bring up Godwin's rule of Hitler analogies, which is actually asserts that an online discussion gets longer and longer, the probability of a comparison involving Hitler approaches one. Comparisons to Hitler, always false equivalence. Thank you very much to Ed Lee. He is the executive director of the Barclay Forum for Debate, Deliberation, and Dialogue at Emory University. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's show, but we would love to hear from you. Give us an example of false equivalence, or frankly, any other logical fallacy that you've heard and bothers you. Call us at 404-500-9457. Godwin's Law, that's one of mine, Hitler comparisons. But let me know yours. You can find us on social media. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.